This KABU program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from the Scanner newspaper, featuring local and national news, and now providing the latest in local and national news from an African-American perspective online at www.thescanner.com. The Scanner provides daily updates that keep people informed. This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Pete's Coffee and Tea, celebrating 43 years with the introduction of Anniversary Blend, featuring a rare find from Burundi. Available for a limited time at Pete's 10 Greater Portland and Vancouver retail locations and online at Pete's.com. That's P-E-E-T-S.com.
I'm Lena Alialoro.
This is Scott Fink.
This is Linda Olsen-Ostman.
This is Owen Bastable.
I'm Cicely Rogers.
I'm Lisa Lewis.
I'm Brian Pritchett.
This is Rebecca Nay.
I'm Robert Barncourt.
Volunteer-run, community-powered. This is the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, Portlanders travel to Arizona to protest immigration policy.
We hear an update on the trial of one of the Angola Three.
And people in Chicago fight to save their schools.
Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Tuesday, March 3rd, 2009. I'm Linda Olsen-Osterlund.
And I'm Robert Barncourt. And now for some updates from Arizona, where a controversial immigration policy was protested this weekend. KABU's Leila Tetzlaff reports.
Sheriff, your time is up. That was the general sentiment expressed by thousands of people on the streets of Phoenix last Saturday. Several Portlanders attended the march there in protest of Sheriff Joseph Arpaio's policies of racial profiling. Arpaio received national condemnation last month for his chaining, shackling, and marching of 220 undocumented immigrant prisoners. The sheriff is also known for targeting people who look Latino in sweeps on homes and businesses. This especially worries some Oregonians who have seen Arizona policies copied locally. One of these policies is a 287G program, which allows law enforcement agents like Arpaio to act as immigration officers. Trillium Shannon is a Portland organizer who responded to the program in Phoenix.
There were about 3,000 to 4,000 people in the streets. It was very high energy. A lot of the signs said things like, "We are human," stop racial profiling, "Being brown is not a crime," and the 287G agreements and the raids, and then a lot of things also tying Joe Arpaio to his connections with the Ku Klux Klan here, which has been documented as well.
Since its creation, the 287G program has been picked up by municipalities in over a dozen states. And according to a report from the nonpartisan group Justice Strategies, the problem with its implementation is not limited to one sheriff. The flaws are in the program itself.
This report actually was recently released, and it doesn't focus so much on Arizona. It may mention it, but basically the 287G programs, as I understand them, are a program that started under Clinton but wasn't really enforced until implemented until after 9/11. And what it does is it allows local law enforcement to enforce immigration law, which is usually a federal enforcement area. And that's led to a lot of abuses. That's what this report is talking about, is that once you put that power into the hands of local law enforcement agencies, not only do people get racially profiled left and right, and in Arizona, of course, they're racially profiling people with brown skin, but it also leads to a number of other abuses and problems, problems such as the police are supposed to be there when you're in trouble, supposedly. And we all know it doesn't always work like that, but just imagine if you are someone who's already being targeted by the police and you are the victim of a crime, rape, domestic violence, robbery, any of those things, you're not likely to call the cops because even though you're a victim of a crime that needs to be investigated, you're going to feel threatened and know that you might be separated from your family if you call the police.
The 287G program hasn't come to Oregon yet. Still, similar acts are being proposed that put federal immigration law enforcement in the hands of local officials. In Columbia County, community members have marched against a newly passed measure that sanctions all businesses employing undocumented workers. But the 287G legislation has been copied even more directly.
There was something similar that had been proposed by the anti-immigrant group Oregonians for Immigration Reform, and that was called the Respect for Law Act, couched in very interesting terms. But what they proposed during the last election cycle, they were unable to get enough signatures. That's great. They didn't get it on the ballot, but they proposed this as part of the Respect for Law Act, that local law enforcement should be able to enforce federal immigration law. So when this is happening in Arizona, and this is happening in Suffolk County, New York, and this is happening in North Carolina, we have to know that it could come to our state next, and that's exactly why we think it needs to stop.
Listeners can learn more about the 287G program and sign a petition against Sheriff Joe Arpaio at www.sheriffjoemustgo.com. For KBOO Evening News, I'm Leila Tetzloff.
A bill that would have banned pit bulls in Oregon has been dropped, at least for this year. Oregon Senator Bruce Starr, Republican from Hillsboro, stated last Monday, late Monday afternoon, that he would not reintroduce the controversial legislation during this year's session. The idea, which came from one of Starr's constituents, had been killed in committee. The news is a victory for pets' rights advocates, but owners already have another fight on their hands. A new proposal would require owners of pit bulls to buy liability insurance. The Pacific Northwest Pit Bull Rescue Organization says they don't think such insurance is affordable for many owners. Thomas said rescue organizations plan to write letters to Oregon legislators to get the insurance bill dropped. If an owner can't pay for insurance, they contend, the dog will end up in a shelter.
Officials say President Barack Obama wants federal agencies to resume full scientific reviews of projects that might harm endangered wildlife and plants, at least for now. The officials, who spoke on condition of anonymity, say the president will sign a memorandum Tuesday to put a Bush administration regulation on hold until the Interior and Commerce Departments complete a review of the rule. Conservationists hope that President Barack Obama's new direction on the Endangered Species Act will derail the U.S. Bureau of Land Management's plan to increase logging in western Oregon. The Bush administration regulation made optional the consultations that federal scientists have performed for 35 years on endangered species decisions. Democrats in Congress are attempting to reverse the rule. Conservationists are challenging the plan in court. Earth Justice lawyer Jeanette Brimmer says the group now hopes to get the Obama administration to order the agency to consult with biologists.
A former Oregon congressman has pled not guilty in Los Angeles to money laundering and tax charges. The charges stem from an investment scheme that allegedly cost investors more than $10 million. Wes Cooley, who represented Oregon's 2nd Congressional District for one term in the 1990s, began the investment scheme after his term in Oregon State Legislature. An indictment filed in January alleges that Cooley and two other men lured victims into purchasing unregistered stock in BidBay.com. They apparently told investors that the company would be acquired by eBay for $20 per share. In 2002 alone, Cooley allegedly took more than $1 million in investor cash and laundered it to conceal the fraud scheme. Cooley's attorney declined to comment on the charges.
And now we go to an update on the prosecution of the Angola 3, recorded earlier today by Linda Olsen-Osterlund.
This is Linda Olsen-Osterlund for KBOO Radio, and today we're joined by Robert King Wilkerson, one of the Angola 3. There are three former members of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense who were held in solitary confinement in the prison at Angola, Louisiana, for over 30 years. The other two members of the Angola 3, Albert Woodfox and Herman Wallace, are still being held in solitary confinement. In 2008, U.S. District Judge Brady overturned the original conviction of Albert Woodfox, and today there was a hearing. Despite the overturning of his conviction, he's still been locked in prison, though not in solitary. How did today's hearing go? What do the lawyers say? Do they expect to be able to get Albert out of prison anytime soon?
Well, the expectation is pretty good. The lawyers expect, I think, and all the lawyers feel, and I've heard from all of them. I talked to Chris, he's one of the lawyers, and Scott Fleming, Chris Abilene, Scott Fleming, and Nick Turner Costa. He was the one that Albert presented the case, rather, and he did a pretty decent job. And I do think that if gauging from layman's and from a professional standpoint, the lawyers that is, they feel that we did a good job in presenting the case. The state, they've been maintaining and claiming the same thing, you know, and I don't think it was enough to persuade the judges. I think everybody believes, and hopefully this belief is well-founded, that Albert will be, that it will be remanded. In other words, they will affirm Judge Brady's ruling overturning Albert's case, and that will give the state 120 days. Of course, they might say add it another 2 months. They might say, well, you got 6 months to try this man or release him. And
so
that is where we are today. And that decision will probably be rendered within the next month, about, 30 days.
Okay.
Within 30 days.
So in about a month, we should be expecting to hear the ruling from today's hearing. Can you say just one word about Herman Wallace and what's happening with his cases?
We noticed that Herman's case is also on appeal, but is not on a federal level yet. He is in the state Supreme Court. We noticed that it was a recommendation by earlier by a state court to overturn his decision, but the jurors did not accept that recommendation, and we appealed, and we are now in the state court. But this case, Herman's case, Albert's case, cannot be seen separately. You have to see one in tandem with each other. They have to be in tandem with each other because it is the same evidence, the same manufactured evidence that convicted Herman, and the state knows this. And, and I believe this, that Herman's case, once we reach the federal level, perhaps before that, maybe the state Supreme Court might decide to, decide to look at the case and really give it the type of justice that it deserves. And so, but if not, then we are prepared to go to the federal court and appeal whatever decision. If it's advised by the state, we are going to appeal that decision. And we feel is that Herman is also optimistic, and he expects to be released sometime soon in the future as well.
And can you tell us what can people do who support Albert Woodfox and the three of you as a group for having been locked up for so long? What can they do now?
I encourage people to continue to support. Go to our website, and people who are seeking as to how they want to give support or whatever expertise they have, go to our website. And our website is www.angola3.org, and there's a lot of information there, and we are linked up with a lot of other websites that can give additional information as to how people can get on board, how they can help. But the main thing is to keep the focus.
Well, thank you. This has been Robert King Wilkerson, one of the Angola 3, talking to us today about the hearing of Albert Woodfox. This is Linda Olson-Osterlund for KBOO News. Thank you. In the human cost of occupation in Iraq, multiple studies have estimated that over 1 million Iraqis have been killed since the U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003. The exact number of civilians killed is unknown, since neither the United States nor Iraqi governments do body counts of civilian casualties in the conflict. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by the other team at 6. Tomorrow's weather is light rain with high of 49 and a low of 36.
The
current time is 5:16, and now, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Once upon a time, not so long ago, Citigroup was a fairy tale financial conglomerate that was the richest corporation in all the land. But it turns out that Citigroup's magic kingdom was, like most Wall Street firms, built on fairy dust. And poof, the kingdom has vanished. Last year, the once mighty bank lost $18.7 billion, fired 39,000 employees, and was reduced from a golden chariot to a pumpkin. It only survives today because of a $52 billion bailout from taxpayers. And where are the executive alchemists who created the fairy dust to make Citigroup seem like so much more than it was? These royal princes of the kingdom, who were paid millions for their magical creations, all retired in riches. But you still might find some of them at the bank. Take Charles Prince, who was CEO of Citigroup until retiring a year and a half ago, just as the fairy dust went poof. Prince, who had been paid $67 million for his first 3 years of overseeing the kingdom, was graced with a $10 million bonus in his last year, even though the empire was collapsing around him. But Prince wasn't sent away. He continues to enjoy a well-appointed office at the bank, an executive assistant, a limo, and a chauffeur. Even though Citigroup is now on a financial death watch, several other of its former executives continue to draw millions of dollars in personal perks. Sandy Wheel, for example, not only has kept an office, staff, and his limo since retiring 3 years ago, but he's also paid a consulting fee of $3,800 a day. This is Jim Hightower saying, you'd hope that at least one of these guys would have the integrity to say, you know, this is a ripoff and I don't deserve it. Rather than wait for that magical moment, however, Congress should step up now and pull the plug on these pampered princes of greed.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publisher of Hightower's new book, Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go With the Flow, now available wherever books are sold.
In Chicago, efforts continue to save some 20 schools from phase-out, closure, and consolidation. Over the last month, actions have included a campout, a public rally in protest, and continuing outreach. The protests have involved teachers, students, activists, and concerned citizens. They've so far succeeded in saving 6 schools from impending closure, and efforts on behalf of the remaining schools are continuing unabated. The schools are scheduled to close under the city's controversial Renaissance 2010 plan.
And now a look at broadband internet access in Middle America with Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clements.
Hundreds of people will meet in Durham, North Carolina on Saturday, March 7th for the second in a series of town hall meetings on the future of the Internet in the United States. The meeting, organized by InternetForEveryone.org, is a chance for everyday citizens to talk about the impacts of the digital divide and how to close it. Tens of millions of Americans live without high-speed internet nationwide, and in North Carolina, nearly 5 million people don't have a broadband connection. Megan Tatey of Free Press spoke to people across the state about the importance of internet access.
Brian Baudet didn't think he would have a problem telecommuting when he bought a house in the mountains of Madison County in western North Carolina with his wife and 3 kids. But Brian, a software engineer, was in for digital culture shock. High-speed internet isn't available in his area. To keep his job, Brian has subscribed to expensive satellite internet, but even that connection can be unreliable. Brian suddenly found himself on the wrong side of the digital divide.
Unfortunately, it's affected me in various ways, including a job I had at the beginning of the year. They were in a dispersed company throughout the country, and there was no home office. And it was a great job. Unfortunately, after 6 months, I realized I wasn't really working out because of my satellite situation. My broadband was too slow, and it really affected my job performance.
Brian says not having broadband puts him at a competitive disadvantage.
We could move in town, and we could sell our house and try to do that route, but with the economy and the housing market as it is, that's a tough call. So I'm a little concerned that my lack of options in broadband will force me to follow those options.
Brian isn't alone. Too many people can't apply for jobs, attend online classes, start home-based businesses, and participate in the global economy because broadband isn't available where they live or it's simply too expensive. Wally Bowen, director of the nonprofit Mountain Area Information Network in Asheville, North Carolina, says many people with broadband aren't even aware that a digital divide still exists.
I think one of the frustrating things for me, being an activist in this world, is going to places like Washington, D.C., or conferences in Minneapolis or St. Louis or wherever, and telling people that, you know, there are people in this world who are still on dial-up, and that's why. I mean, it's like some sort of moral failure or some sort of ignorance about, you know, why don't they use broadband? Well, they don't understand where people live in rural areas. Many of them don't have access to high-speed internet. And it's, you know, once you have high-speed, you just think, well, everybody has high-speed. And so this has been a real struggle to communicate that so many of our fellow citizens have been, you know, left behind.
Yet as half of the country is left behind, it's becoming increasingly clear that a connected nation is the key to revitalizing the economy and rescuing local communities. Tim Will, executive director of Foothills Connect Business and Technology Center in Rutherford, says North Carolina has been hard hit by the vanishing textile industry. With the jobless rate climbing, Tim says the opportunities from broadband, which is sparse in the county, could breathe new life into the community.
If you don't have broadband, you're not going to get economic development. If you don't have access to broadband, obviously no company is going to move into your area because they're going to demand broadband.
Ironically, the United States, the birthplace of the internet, has fallen far behind other countries in terms of broadband speed, deployment, and cost. The economic stimulus bill just signed into law by President Obama allocates $7.2 billion for broadband expansion. But that's just a piece of the much larger puzzle to bring the benefits of the internet to all Americans. Brian Baudet hopes the funds will help connect his community because the consequences without broadband are dire.
Now you end up with almost a class-based system where you have people that have information and people that don't. People that can get things done in a fast and reliable way and people that can't.
To see more profiles about the digital divide in North Carolina and across the country, visit internetforeveryone.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The CEO of the biggest banking failure in United Kingdom corporate history has walked away with a golden handshake from the British government. But angry taxpayers want their money back. From London, FSRN's Naomi Fowler reports on the scandal.
Around $1 million in annual income and a pension payoff that was doubled to $23 million at the height of the bank collapse over which he presided. The 50-year-old ex-CEO of the now state-controlled Royal Bank of Scotland, Sir Fred Goodwin, believes it's fair, and he's refusing the government's request to volunteer a reduction. The government claims it was unaware the pension deal was discretionary and that it could have insisted on a much lower amount that reflected the failings of the bank. The bank was rescued with $28 billion of public money in October. The taxpayer is also about to guarantee $460 billion worth of toxic loans. The government now says it's seeking legal advice, while opposition parties are expressing concerns about the government's ability to negotiate with and jointly operate banks. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
Dozens of bodies have been found in hastily dug mass graves in Dhaka, Bangladesh, one day after revolting border guards laid down their arms. The mass graves contain the bodies of at least 66 commanding officers, and many other officers are still missing. The guards had occupied their border station in the capital for 2 days, demanding higher salaries. 300 guards have been arrested, and Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina Wajed says there will be no amnesty for anyone involved in the killings.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Tuesday, March 3rd, 2009. Three Palestinians die in Gaza, and the army kidnaps 16 civilians from the West Bank. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Two Palestinians who were injured during the Israeli offensive on Gaza died of their wounds in an Egyptian hospital on Tuesday. The Palestinian Ministry of Health reported that the bodies of the two patients were transferred back to Gaza via the Rafah terminal. Also on Tuesday, the Egyptian authorities allowed the transfer of 22 patients back to Gaza after receiving medical treatment. Palestinian sources at the Rafah terminal reported that Egypt informed the Palestinian side of the crossing that the terminal would be opened in both directions for 3 days next week. On Monday night, a Palestinian patient from Khan Yunis in the southern part of the Gaza Strip died after Israel barred him from leaving the Gaza Strip for medical treatment abroad. Israeli jet fighters have conducted several bombing raids in the southern Gaza Strip city of Rafah along the borders with Egypt on Tuesday afternoon. Witnesses said that the jet fired several missiles at open areas along the borderline. The Israeli army says that this area has underground tunnels, which Israel claims the Palestinian factions used to smuggle weapons into Gaza. Palestinian medical sources said that ambulances rushed to the bombarded areas, but no injuries were reported. Earlier on Tuesday, Israeli tanks at the borders near Khan Yunis town in central Gaza opened fire on farmers whilst working on their land nearby. Medical sources reported no injuries. At least 16 Palestinian civilians were reported to have been kidnapped by the Israeli military during early morning invasions, targeting several communities all over the West Bank on Tuesday. 8 civilians were kidnapped from Nablus, 7 from Ramallah and 1 from Hebron, local sources reported. Thank you for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. You have been listening to Palestine Today from the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org. This report has been brought to you by Mary Arthur and Ghazan Benoura.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we are open to your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Caleb Shapala, William Sell, and Kyle Burris. Special thanks to reporters Lila Tetzlaff and Linda Olson-Osterlund. Our engineer is Kyle Burris. The KABU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Yenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on the KABU website at kboo.fm. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. I'm Robert Barncourt.
And I'm Linda Olson-Osterlund. Coming up tomorrow morning on KABU, at 7, it's Democracy Now!, hosted by Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Barbara Bernstein hosts Locus Focus Talk Radio. She's joined by Arjun Mahajani, president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research, for a discussion about why nuclear power is no better an idea now than it was 30 years ago. At 9 on Alternative Radio, the speaker is journalist Nina Baker, author of The Body Toxic, How the Hazardous Chemicals of Everyday Things Threaten Our Health and Well-Being. Baker is a former staff writer for The Oregonian. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, hosted by Chris Andre and Liam Delta. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, it's The Bike Show at a new time. The show will celebrate amazing cyclists, learn more about local bike heroes, and the upcoming Alice B. Toeclips Awards ceremony that will honor their good work. Call in with your bike heroes at 503-231-8187. And now, stay tuned for more national and international news from the Worker Run Collective at Free Speech Radio News. Good night, Robert.
Good night, Linda.
From Pacifica Station, KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Free Speech Radio News. It's Tuesday, the 3rd of March, 2009. Sri Lanka's cricket team is attacked in Pakistan. 8 are killed, and the incident raises tensions with India. Cuban President Raul Castro shakes up his cabinet, distancing himself from some of his brother's closest consultants. And on another installment of our ongoing energy series, we'll hear why Native Americans are wondering if Obama's plans will bring green change. I'm Aura Bogado. Those stories after this news.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Survivors of a mudslide at a remote mining camp in Peru received food, blankets, and medicine today. 10 people are dead and 16 still missing. Rescuers were finally able to evacuate seriously wounded miners by helicopter. Some 50 homes at the Winchamayo Gold Mining Camp were destroyed yesterday after heavy rains. The camp is at least a 15-hour hike from the nearest road. The U.S. Supreme Court heard spirited arguments today in a case about whether and when judges should recuse themselves. In Caperton v. Massey Energy, the plaintiffs say that Massey Energy's CEO spent $3 million on West Virginia State Supreme Court Justice Brent Benjamin's campaign for the bench. Benjamin then presided over a matter that was decided in Massey's favor to the tune of $50 million. The Supreme Court also handed down opinions today. In Negi C. v. Holder, the court held that a former prison guard who was forced to mistreat inmates still qualifies for asylum if he was coerced or under duress. And in Summers v. Earth Island Institute, the High Court said that the U.S. Forest Service does not have to hear public comment on projects that they deem to be small in scope. Zimbabwe's High Court today ordered Deputy Minister Designate Roy Bennett released from jail, but prosecutors immediately lodged another appeal and he remains behind bars. Just yesterday, a prominent human rights activist and leader of the Zimbabwe Peace Project was freed on bail. She says she was severely tortured during her detention. Moses Magadza reports.
Justina Mukoko is a former newscaster and now a human rights activist in Zimbabwe. State security agents abducted her from her house at dawn 3 months ago. She was in her sleeping clothes when she was kidnapped and taken to a secret location. After weeks of denying any knowledge of her whereabouts, police bowed to pressure from the international community and the Opposition for Democratic Change and took her to court. She was charged with treason for allegedly recruiting people to be trained as bandits in Botswana. She denies the charges, which have soiled diplomatic relations between the two countries. Yesterday, a court freed Mukoko and 4 others on bail. She remained in hospital after authorities repeatedly denied her necessary medical care. Mukoko is now frail and said she was tortured while in custody. Media reports said she forced a weak smile when she was unshackled yesterday and told reporters it felt good to be free. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Moses Magadza.
President Obama put a hold on another of former President Bush's midnight regulations today. He issued a presidential memo that reinstates full scientific reviews of projects that might harm endangered species, either flora or fauna. In the waning days of his presidency, Bush issued a regulation that made such reviews optional. A North Carolina mother has been granted a military discharge after showing up for duty with her children in tow. Linda Marie Tarasi reports from Chapel Hill.
Lisa Pagan of Charlotte, North Carolina, reported to duty at Fort Benning, Georgia, Monday morning with her 5-year-old son and 3-year-old daughter. She had been recalled to duty 4 years after being released from active status under the military's Individual Ready Reserve Program, which is able to recall military personnel who have time left on their original enlistment contracts but are not currently active. Pagan had continually asked for an exemption, which had been rejected, before reporting to duty because she says she is without child care. Her attorney, Mark Waple of Fayetteville, North Carolina, says it isn't yet clear if Pagan will receive an honorable discharge or a general discharge under honorable conditions. A Fort Benning spokesperson said that child care was available for Pagan's children when she reported to the Army Post-Mobilization Center that prepares individual soldiers to join Army units already overseas or those training to deploy. Waple says Pagan is relieved and believes Fort Benning is going to expedite the matter so she can return to Charlotte. He advised Pagan against talking to the media until after the discharge was official. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Linda Marie Taurasi in Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
February sales figures are out for the auto industry. Compared to the same month last year, General Motors said sales fell 52.9%, Ford reports a 48% decline, and Volkswagen is down by 18%. Toyota, the world's largest car maker, says they're off 37% and are asking the Japanese government-backed bank for a $2 billion loan. Subaru, however, posts an increase in sales. They're up 1%. For Free Speech Radio News from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
Sri Lanka's cricket team was attacked in Lahore, Pakistan. The ambush claimed the lives of 5 policemen and injured 7 players, a coach, and an umpire. It's unclear who orchestrated or carried out the assault, if the Sri Lankan team was the target, or if they were caught up in violence between rival groups. Puck Lowe reads for our correspondent in Pakistan, Gabe Matthews.
In Pakistan's cultural capital of Lahore, police erected barricades and roadblocks and began their search for the attackers. The Tuesday morning gun and grenade attack killed 8 people, including 6 policemen, and injured 15 people, including 6 Sri Lankan cricket players. The attack happened when the Sri Lankan cricket team was in Lahore, en route to the cricket stadium for the 3rd day of matches with Pakistan's team. Lahore is the capital of Punjab province, the most populated province in Pakistan. Government spokesperson Sherry Rahman spoke at a press conference in Islamabad.
Report aur jab tak tehqiqat puri nahi ho jaye aur wo tezi se hongi, hum is par koi.
It's too early to say anything about who's involved in the attack. We are a responsible democratic government, and we will bring forth the truth after a proper investigation. Only then will we come to a conclusion.
Sri Lanka agreed to a cricket series after many international cricket teams rejected Pakistan due to security reasons. The International Cricket Council banned international cricket matches in Pakistan after this attack. And now, many suspect these attacks will end cricket games indefinitely, affecting many businesses. Muzamil Shah is a businessman with 5 crockery and electronic shops in Lahore.
I left Lahore and came to Islamabad because my family was worried and afraid. The situation has been very tense after the attack. Every businessman is worried for his business. This incident has collapsed our businesses, which was already in a deplorable condition due to the bad security situation. The terrorists did not only injure Sri Lankan players, but also the Pakistan economy. It will be very difficult for foreigners to invest after this incident.
Some say security was not tight enough for the cricket players, especially after the Supreme Court banned the provincial chief minister from election last week, forcing him to step down. Since then, the governor has been in charge of security in the province. Meanwhile, the incident is likely to reignite tensions with India. Some accuse India of being involved in the attack, including a popular Islamabad-based investigative journalist. Ansar Abbasi appeared on TV Tuesday, showing a letter from Pakistani intelligence. It allegedly warns of this attack as early as February 22nd and suggests that Indian intelligence was behind it. Reading for Gabe Matthews in Pakistan, this is Pak Lo for FSRN.
The Justice Department released 9 Bush administration memos that justified broad presidential powers after September 11. The memos state the president has the power to use the military within the United States against suspected terrorists, that the president has the right to conduct warrantless surveillance and searches within the United States, and that First Amendment rights to free speech and freedom of the press could be suppressed. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
All 9 memos interpreted that the U.S. was involved in the war on terror. One memo was written 5 weeks after September 11th, written by John Yoo of the Office of Legal Counsel. It provides 37 pages to justify the president's authority to deploy troops within U.S. borders to fight suspected terrorists. It cites the Whiskey Rebellion of 1794 and the Civil War as precedent. Another memo, written 2 weeks after September 11th, also by John Yoo, gives the legal justification for the president to conduct warrantless surveillance inside the U.S. It says the Fourth Amendment balances the right of the individual with the interests of the government. The memo says, in these times, the government's national security interest is far greater. The memo also states that freedom of the press could be curbed in favor of national security. Other memos say the president has the sole authority to detain and transfer detainees without the consent of Congress, and that the president could rescind international treaties.
They're memos that take the broadest possible interpretation of presidential power.
Jamil Joffer is an attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union. He goes one step further.
So broad that they are certainly unconstitutional.
Obama's Justice Department released the 9 memos in the name of openness and transparency. A couple of the memos were rescinded during the Bush years, but the rest weren't until January 15th, just 5 days before Bush left office.
I mean, the suggestion is that it's bad for the Justice Department to try to figure this out.
Republican Senator John Cornyn of Texas quantifies the memos as legal research.
I don't think it particularly shows anything other than they were trying to do their job.
Jamil Joffer says the release of the legal memos don't paint the whole picture.
The legal memos don't themselves tell us what the executive branch actually did. And I think that's a question that hasn't been answered.
Joffer says this prompts, at the least, a congressional investigation, but warrants a criminal probe into the Bush administration. Chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee Patrick Leahy is holding a Truth Commission Wednesday. It will explore apparent and possible legal violations on the wars, the Patriot Act, torture, and more. President Obama has not supported any investigation. He says people need to look forward, not backward. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Cuban President Raul Castro has shaken up that country's cabinet, ousting several of Fidel Castro's closest advisors. Included in that list is Felipe Perez Roque, who some thought might be next in line to become president of the socialist island nation. It's unclear if the shakeup connotes a significant power change or simply a generational change. Larry Burns is the director of the Washington-based Council on Hemispheric Affairs. He says what's happening in Cuba is an evolving situation.
Here you have a government that's been dominated by one man for decades, and his beloved brother has come in. We don't know much about this man, even though he's been around equally long. And Raul Castro has done certain things. Either he has had the willing consent of his brother, or he's done it in spite of his brother, but I just don't see that, given the nature of Cuban politics, that Raul would take a decisive step without clearing it to some degree with his brother. But, you know, the other day, Hugo Chavez, who, of course, is a great friend of Fidel Castro, made a trip to Cuba. There is some speculation that he was attempting to dissuade Raul from getting rid of Roque, who's the foreign minister, and the Carlos Laje, who's the vice president. I mean, these are people who are very close to Fidel Castro. He had selected them. Now, there it is. We certainly can look at what's happened in Cuba in recent weeks and months and perhaps gain some sort of illumination that way. But it may be a mistake to try to generate a false tension within the Cuban government of one camp against another which may not actually exist.
Are you surprised at this move by Raul Castro?
I am surprised at the move, largely because things are usually so scripted in Cuba. Cuba is going through a very dramatic period right now. There are major economic changes of circumstances which need to be recorded. And Cuba has made its debut in the Inter-American Amphitheater. That is, Cuba has really defeated the United States diplomatically. Washington's efforts to isolate Cuba have failed, and it is Cuba that emerges with the important relationships and not the United States.
And what do you think this might mean for Cuba-U.S. relations?
It all depends. You know, we have people like Senator Menendez of New Jersey, a liberal on all things, but he has a Cuban constituency and he's Cuban himself, and he intends to block any kind of movement in terms of liberalizing relations with Cuba. On the other hand, Senator Richard Lugar of Pennsylvania the other day came out with a report in which he said the embargo is dead. The embargo never worked. President Obama's position is really to the right of Lugar's, and it will be interesting to see whether Lugar's assertions are going to gain dominance, because there's really a mix-up here in terms of the power that's being put behind various proposals. It's quite possible that liberals in the administration are going to stand firm vis-a-vis Obama on his Cuba policy. His Cuba policy seems to be almost an enlightened Republican Party policy, not a policy that's being put forth by liberal Democrats.
Larry Burns is the director of the Washington-based Council on Hemispheric Affairs. You're listening to FSRN. I'm Aura Bogado. A congressional committee heard testimony today about health services for inmates in Immigration and Customs Enforcement detention. Critics cite the number of people who have died in custody, as well as the general health care provided to detainees, including those with existing mental and physical conditions. Peter Granitz reports.
The hearing follows a string of media reports detailing unhealthy detentions and detainee deaths. 11 detainees died in ICE custody in 2008. 9 more have died in the first 5 months of this fiscal year. ICE has detained more than 1.7 million people since it was created as part of the Department of Homeland Security in 2003. But the Division of Immigration Health Services only has 700 doctors, nurses, and other healthcare professionals.
90% of our detainee population has generally not received adequate health care prior to entering ICE custody.
That's James Hayes, director of ICE's detention and removal operations. He said detainees are given a health interview within 24 hours of being arrested. Those health exams don't seem to impress Congressmember Sam Farr.
Those oral screenings are done by officers or by staff?
It could be done by someone other than a doctor, yes. Yeah.
Critics like the California Democrat say those interviews largely ignore infectious diseases because detainees don't know they have them. A GAO report released in February showed the mortality rate at ICE facilities has decreased by nearly 11 per 100,000 in 2004, down to about 3 in 2008. Hayes says that's a sizable improvement considering the health status of detainees.
Our population is generally in poorer health, certainly than the prison population of other prison populations in the United States.
But ICE's Hayes said his department doesn't need any more money for health care, despite his assurance to improve care. Joanne Lynn is with the ACLU.
Somehow ICE plans to improve the quality of health care for immigration detainees with the same amount of money for an additional 100,000 detainees in this upcoming year.
Lawmakers oftentimes use subcommittee meetings like today's to express their overall opinion on a government organization. Today was no different, especially for Congressmember Farr.
They're not all detained because of they have an outstanding warrant.
Now, some of those cases of warrant of arrest will be filed after the arrest. That's correct.
Farr represents the Central Coast south of San Francisco, which has a large Latino population. The president hasn't released an agency-by-agency budget for the next fiscal year. When he does in April, we'll see whether ICE will have another increased budget. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Peter Grant in Washington.
President Obama met with Interior Secretary Ken Salazar today to discuss the new energy economy. The Interior Department announced plans to, quote, promote energy security with a focus on clean, renewable sources, unquote. A large portion of Obama's economic stimulus package is geared toward creating a new energy economy, but how much of that money will apply to Native American tribes? Some Native Americans who are trying to develop a green energy economy on reservations across the Western Plains are questioning whether Obama will bring real change to tribe economies dependent on unsustainable industries. In our latest story from our Running on Empty Energy series, Blake Wesley files this report.
On the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, Henry Redcloud has been installing wind turbines and solar heaters for members of the Lakota tribe. Redcloud says creating a green economy with renewable energy matches Native philosophy of caring for the earth.
Our ancestors were like that in the past. They were, you know, sustainable off the land, being closely related to wind, sun, you know, solar. The spirit of the sun in all our, you know, ceremonies.
With more than a quarter of all Native Americans living in poverty and an unemployment rate reaching 80% on Pine Ridge, Redcloud opened a renewable energy center to try to create green jobs by training members of the Lakota tribe how to manufacture sustainable energy systems.
We do all phases of solar electric as well as solar hot water and solar air heater. And also residential scale wind turbines.
Green jobs and renewable energy have been featured prominently in President Obama's economic stimulus plan. In fact, the law includes nearly $80 billion in funding for developing a clean energy economy and plans to create green jobs by investing more than $8 billion in renewable energy projects like wind, solar, and hydropower. But Redcloud and others question whether American Indian tribes will be included in these initiatives. Tom Goldtooth is the executive director for the Indigenous Environmental Network, an organization aimed towards creating energy independence on tribal land. Goldtooth says it's unclear whether stimulus money will go towards developing renewable energy projects on reservations.
You know, our position is that definitely, you know, we need to have a piece of the pie. You know, as First Nations, as original peoples of this land, you know, we've been underserved. We've been continuously underserved, you know, by the United States government throughout the years.
The stimulus provides as much as $3 billion for tribes, with much of the funding going towards restoring tribal water facilities for clean drinking water and law enforcement. About $500 million will go towards rebuilding healthcare facilities, and another $500 million is directed towards repairing roads, schools, and housing on Indian reservations. However, the bill fails to identify renewable energy projects that would put Native tribes on the path towards a clean energy economy. In December, a coalition of Alaskan Native and American Indian groups met with Obama's transition team and urged them to include funding for solar energy projects and tribal wind power in the stimulus. These projects are just as important to some tribes, including Lakota, Hopi, and Navajo, which are trying to move away from the uranium, coal, and oil and gas industries they've historically relied on to fuel their economy. Again, Tom Goldtooth.
And these corporations and working in cahoots with the United States government and state governments have created policies of disempowerment of our Indian people.
But Goldtooth says a new Native energy movement is trying to change all that. You're calling for more help from the Obama administration.
So what we're looking for in the Obama administration is a recognition of these decades of economic and environmental injustices within Indian country, and to work towards addressing these issues.
But he says it's going to take work, and they'll have to continue to challenge the Obama administration to change any policy and reach out to Native tribes. And until that time, Goldtooth and Redcloud say they'll continue to build their communities from the bottom up by creating a green energy economy. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Blake Wesley.
And you can hear other stories from our energy series, Running on Empty, on our website, ssrn.org. The 5th Annual Israeli Apartheid Week has launched in more than 40 cities across the world this week, and the event brings along with it its fair share of controversy. SSRN's Aaron Lakoff reports on some of the advances and setbacks for Palestinian human rights advocates at campuses across the U.S. and Canada.
People in Gaza may still be picking up the pieces of their cities and towns after Israel's three-week offensive last month, but in North America, thousands of miles away, a battle is still raging. At university and college campuses across the continent, there has been a growing momentum around the campaign for boycotts, divestments, and sanctions, or BDS, against Israel in order to force the country to comply with international law vis-à-vis its treatment of Palestinians. Israeli Apartheid Week, an initiative which began in Toronto 5 years ago and has now become an international event, is a series of lectures on campuses designed to mobilize support around the BDS campaign. However, last week, in the lead-up to Israeli Apartheid Week, many Canadian university administrations decided to take swift action to deal with this controversial event. At two major universities in Ottawa, the administrations banned posters announcing the event. Jessica Carpinone is with Students Against Israeli Apartheid at Carleton University.
There's lots of evidence that's circulating now that this is a wider campaign from university administrations to deliberately silence some of the events that go on surrounding Palestine. I mean, it's no secret that organizations, in particular B'nai B'rith, actively is asking university presidents to ban Israeli Apartheid Week.
The University of Ottawa, which also banned the poster, refused to comment on the issue. The posters for the event, which depict an Israeli helicopter firing a missile at a Palestinian child in Gaza, were also banned at Wilfrid Laurier University in Ontario and at York University in Toronto. A local chapter of Students Against Israeli Apartheid was fined over $1,000 and suspended for 30 days due to a rally against the war in Gaza held earlier this month. In the United States and Canada, there's also a growing momentum to cut ties with educational institutions in Israel. CUPE Ontario, a union representing 180,000 workers, passed a resolution on February 22nd in favor of the academic boycott of Israel. Hampshire College, a relatively small school in western Massachusetts, recently voted to divest from six companies involved in the Israeli occupation. Matan Cohen, an Israeli student at Hampshire and a member of Students for Justice in Palestine, thinks that despite the large reaction coming from the pro-Israel lobby in the U.S., his college's actions will have a profound impact.
We've been getting dozens and dozens of emails from across the country of people and groups saying that are starting divestment campaigns, and they are basically looking into the platform, so to speak, that we use at Hampshire in order for them to really go about this BDS campaign.
Hampshire College was also the first school in the U.S. to divest from apartheid South Africa in 1977. Despite the censorship that many students in North America are facing, organizers are expecting Israeli Apartheid Week to proceed without interference. Abby Littman is a Jewish professor at McGill University in Montreal and was one of over 100 educational workers in Quebec who signed an open letter recently in support of the BDS movement against Israeli apartheid.
I hope there will be many discussions and debates about the Middle East and about a range of controversial issues at our educational institutions. We are institutes of learning, and how better to learn than through the exchange of ideas and opinions? If universities and colleges are to live up to the standards of fairness and transparency required to ensure free and open exchanges, they might strive to foster these exchanges and cease all they do to hamper or squelch them.
This is Aaron Lakoff reporting for FSRN from Montreal.
And that wraps it up for today's newscast. You've been listening to FSRN, which is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. You can send us your feedback. Just drop us an email to comments@fsrn.org. Our newscast is produced by Catherine Comp and Vinod Joes. Our Washington, D.C. editor is Leanne Caldwell, and our headlines editors are Nell Abram and Jess Burns. Our tech team at KPFA in Berkeley today includes Puck Lowe and Rose Katapchi. At Pacifica Station, KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.
everybody. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM. The time is now just 50 seconds after 6 o'clock. Coming up next on the air is The Other Team, the Used Gay Talk Show. But for right now, let's listen to some announcements.
Sunday, March 8th is International Women's Day, and KBOO is celebrating with a full day of music and special features. Tune in between 6 a.m. Sunday and 3 a.m. Monday for women in jazz, cowgirl music, oral histories, special interviews, and much more. KBOO is going to honor women's contributions and raise awareness of the issues that challenge us to action. Check out the full schedule online at kboo.fm. Join us Sunday, March 8th for International Women's Day on KBOO 90.7 FM.
Hello, this is Leah Bolger from Veterans for Peace and the campaign to keep Oregon's National Guard in Oregon. This month marks the 6th anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. On March 15th, Oregonians from across the state will gather together in Salem to tell our state lawmakers to stop the wars at home and abroad, keep Oregon's guard home from Iraq and Afghanistan. The march and rally will begin at 1 p.m. on the steps of the state capitol. I urge you to join me and thousands of Oregonians in Salem on Sunday, March 15th, to tell our legislature to keep Oregon's guard in Oregon.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the next big rally and march for peace, March 15th at 1 p.m. at the steps of the Capitol in Salem, Oregon. For more information, call 503-236-3065. Buses and carpools are available.
I believe it could be something good has begun.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay and Lesbian Community Yellow Pages, providing a wide array of gay-friendly business listings. For more information, you can call 503-230-7701 or you can visit them on the web at www.pdxgayyellowpages.com.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair-accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212. In Vancouver at 360-694-1234 or RadioCab.net.
Hello, this is Gray.
And this is Darwin.
And you're listening to The Other Team on 90.7 KBOO. 90.7 KBOO. And today on the show, we're going to be talking to Jessica Lee from Basic Rights Oregon about the anti-bullying legislation. And we'll also be talking to Sprout Chin, a youth who was nominated to attend the Junior National Young Leaders Conference in Washington, D.C. And we will be joined by a youth from the city of Portland with whom we will talk about recent transportation issues that will impact the youth community.
Hello, Jessica and Tosh. Sorry, I forgot to introduce you earlier, Tosh. And welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
All right. Can you tell us exactly what this legislation that you're working on now is going to do to help stop bullying and make schools safer for youth?
Sure. So the legislation that we are working on at Basic Rights Oregon, along with a really broad coalition of lots of different organizations from a really broad representation throughout the state, is called the Oregon Safe Schools Act. And to be more specific, House Bill 2599. And what this act would do is really strengthen and give teeth to an existing law that we have in Oregon. So Oregon does have an anti-bullying law, but the issue is that it basically requires all school districts, and there's about 200 in the state of Oregon, to adopt some sort of anti-bullying policy. And then it makes a lot of suggestions, and it also encourages a lot of things. I mean, it has a lot of great ideas, but it doesn't actually enforce these ideas, and it doesn't really require much of the school districts to do. And so what we know is that there's just a big patchwork of policies and protections across the state that aren't to our satisfactory. And out of those 200 school districts, we only know that about 70 have actually put in place some kind of anti-bullying harassment policy. And again, they all look pretty different. And for purposes of protecting all youth, and particularly for us, we're really concerned about lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender youth who are disproportionately bullied and harassed in schools, that only 15% of all those school districts that even just had policies included sexual orientation under their protections, and only 1%, actually less than 1%, because only one school district that we could find in the state included gender identity protections, and we just don't think that's good enough. So the law that we're working on, again, the Oregon Safe Schools Act, would actually create a few big changes. One, it would create a uniform policy that all school districts would have to adopt, and would have to adopt as soon as the law passed. So we're expecting that school districts would have to put these in place by the following school year. It would also create protected classes to say that even though bullying and harassment is not limited to these protected classes, we know that there are some students in schools who get disproportionately bullied and harassed, and that should be acknowledged. And that includes a lot of different students who are just perceived as different, and that includes, of course, queer youth. It includes students of color. It includes students of different faiths, students with disabilities, et cetera. And so for us, this would be a really great base to have a lot of education around why these folks are bullied, what we can do about it, and what we can do to change the climate in the schools around that type of bullying. And then a couple other things that the law would do would make sure that the school community, meaning staff, faculty, students, and families, know exactly what their school district's bullying policy is, that they know what their rights are if bullying harassment happens and who they should go talk to and what should happen. Right now, again, we know that that isn't happening across the state. And lastly, we're really trying to make sure that school districts are getting resources that they need to understand how to interrupt and stop bullying when it happens, but also how to prevent the problem itself and change the climate in their schools. And when other states and countries have implemented comprehensive anti-bullying policies, they've seen bullying drop as up to half in their districts. So this is something we're really excited about and something that we know works.
Wow. Excellent. So, Tosh, could you tell us what Q Power is and what that group is doing to get this legislation passed?
Absolutely. QPower is a group that's part of Basic Rights Oregon. It's a youth-led group. It stands for Queer Portlanders Organizing and Working for Equal Rights. We're very excited because this is really the first time that Basic Rights Oregon has had a group specifically of youth doing political and activist work. And it's also one of the few groups in Portland that's queer and trans-specific and allied young folks just working politically on these issues. So what QPower is doing to get the legislation passed is just interacting. We've been going to a lot of gay straight alliances along with Basic Rights Oregon staff, trying to recruit youth and students to, you know, talk about their personal stories, to write down or tell their personal stories to their lawmakers, to come to the lobby day. At the lobby day, which is this Friday, March 6th, in Salem, we're going to be hosting a youth space so that youth from all around the state will have a chance to interact with each other and check out what resources are available, as well as take some really cool workshops and learn more about an array of stuff.
All right. Now, I know some people are unaware of why it's so important for LGBTQ youth to be protected. Could you, Jessica, could you speak to why that's so important?
Sure. I think that if you are a queer youth or a young LGBT person, it's not surprising at all that where we find this to be a huge problem in schools around bullying and harassment. But it's sadly just a well-known national statistic that LGBT youth are 3 times more likely to drop out of school. They're also 3 times more likely to end up homeless, to develop drug addictions, to attempt and commit suicide. And we know that isn't something that's limited to the rest of the country. That's something that is felt really deeply here in Oregon. In actuality, they just recently, less than a year ago, released a report that analyzed all this data they did around serving students in public schools. And it was the first time they really looked and asked people if they identified around sexual orientation. And the students who said that they identified as either queer or questioning had really huge proportions of harassment and discrimination identified. They were twice as likely to be harassed in their schools. They were much more likely to engage in smoking and in other drug addictions. And they also, which was really, really hard to see, they also reported that within the last 30 days, 24%, almost 1 in 4 of these students who identified as queer or questioning had attempted suicide. And we're talking about Oregon students.
Wow.
And we know that bullying and harassment has a direct effect of why that's happening and how LGBT youth experience their everyday life. And so we think this can make a huge impact, not only for the well-being of someone's education, which is a really important factor, but for the fact that people deserve to feel safe. They deserve to be able to be successful. We don't think that there should be a disproportionate amount of young LGBT people on the streets and attempting and committing suicide. And it really points to a really larger problem.
All right. Who can queer youth turn to if they need someone to advocate for them in their school right now? Can anyone?
Yeah, well, I can definitely speak to my experience. It's been a couple years since I was in high school. I mean, I think there's a lot of different folks students can go to. If there's a gay-straight alliance or a group like that, usually the advisor of that group is a great person who really knows the way and makes themselves available as a resource. Lots of times guidance counselors can be really, really great resources, teachers, administrators. And a lot of times folks will even, you know, helpfully identify themselves by having safe zone posters. And I think with this law, what we also are hoping will happen is giving administrators and teachers and counselors and staff at schools more tools to be able to help folks, because I think there is a lack of that right now. And that's, you know, ideally a student who's being bullied or harassed would be able to go to any staff member of the school and be helped.
Cool. Yeah. All right. So you spoke a little bit about the legal measures in place now to help prevent bullying. Could you speak a little more if there's anything that really to help aid students who are being bullied?
Sure. So I mentioned a little earlier that there is an anti-bullying law in Oregon, which is fantastic, and that passed in 2001, and a lot of states don't have any protections like that. So we are pretty lucky in that sense. The sort of couple things that the law does state is that how it defines bullying and harassment is if someone physically harms you, your body, or your property, which we don't think is good enough. We know that there is a whole level of psychological and emotional well-being that isn't being addressed, but that for sure in the current law is indicated as bullying and harassment and is something that you could be able to go and use this law to help protect yourself. What we also know is because school districts are given the opportunity to then create their own policies, there are some districts in the state that have really, really great protections, and some districts that we don't even know if they have any protections, but some of the districts that do have great protections are outlined within their anti-bullying policy, and sometimes they're very detailed, and oftentimes students do have really good rights to be protected here. You know, Portland Public Schools definitely has a good anti-bullying policy. But then there are just other districts that we don't know. So that's sort of the issue, that depending where you live, it could be completely different. So I don't know what everyone's protections are, and we want to make them uniform.
Right. Cool. What can students do to be allies to their friends who are being bullied?
Yeah, there's a lot of great things students can do. Being in a position of being an ally, you know, when you're not the person who's being bullied, when you're not the person who's in a group that's being targeted, it's so much easier, really, to intervene or interrupt, kind of get a word in to stop what's going on. A lot of times students can just really make things clear, like, this is not okay with me using this language. The way you're treating this person isn't okay with me. You know, also just, like, talking to their peers about it and brainstorming with their administrators, going to staff and faculty and saying, I'm seeing this happen. This is a problem. But I think there's really great opportunities in terms of interacting with other students who are bullying folks and just being able to say, this is not okay and this needs to stop and this is why and this is wrong. So.
And what do you feel that teachers and other adults can do to be allies to youth who are being bullied?
Either one.
I think, you know, teachers, I think, what I've seen work really well in when I was in high school, I think the safe zone signs, I think when teachers, like, really set the tone for their classrooms that certain language is not going to be used and a level of respect is going to be upheld, that's a great way to just set that tone immediately. And making clear that you're there for the students, you're there to listen to them, you're there to make sure that they are feeling safe and able to learn, because we know when students are feeling afraid, it affects their ability to learn. So I think teachers and staff have, you know, a really vested interest in making sure that all the students at their schools feel real safe and protected.
The one thing I would add to that, too, is sort of both teachers, faculty, and beyond, just generally adults. I've heard that a lot of youth have tried to talk to somebody, tried to tell them they've been bullied or harassed, and they've often gotten the response, well, you know, tough it out, you know, suck it up. That happens, you know, you must have provoked it, or, you know, you'll get through it, it's not a big deal. And I think that a lot of times what adults may not recognize is how severely it impacts people, particularly when it's happening over and over again, and often when your identity is being attacked at that severe of a level, what that really does to a person. And to really even just stand there and listen and understand that this is a real severe issue, as opposed to writing it off. It's not just a kids being kids type of thing. It's much more bigger than that.
Right.
All right. And how can teachers and other faculty in public schools make the schools a safe place for all students in terms of more than just being an ally to a specific youth who you know is being bullied, but creating a safe atmosphere where bullying is less likely to happen in the first place?
I think some of the things that Tosh mentioned earlier about being an out and vocal ally, in whatever respect, because we're all allies in some respect, to have visual representation, such as a safe zone sign in your room, to be able to speak openly and clearly how you feel about certain issues and to stop certain language and harassment when it's happening is really, really key. But also having teachers and faculty being willing to be advisors of things like GSAs. Also, if staff and faculty identify as someone who is LGBT or as someone who belongs to another community that often gets targeted, to be open and out about it and to really be proud around their identity and to let students know that that's okay and that it's not okay for them to be attacked because of it, sets a really, really great precedent.
You mentioned the Safe Zone posters several times. I know we had them up quite a few places in the high school I attended, but some people may be less familiar with them. Could you describe what those posters look like and if there are different kinds? Or?
Yeah, Safe Zone posters usually feature a triangle, and they usually say, like, you know, this space accepts people regardless of sexual orientation, gender identity, socioeconomic status, race, ethnicity, ability. And I think there's a lot of variation of what gets included in that. Sometimes safe zone signs are specifically for LGBT folks. And really, the safe zone signs make it clear, like, this, you know, hateful language is not acceptable in this space.
That is really great. I know I've seen a variety of different safe zone posters, some of which were more specifically LGBT, and a lot of them were very universal, and they always made me feel safer, especially when they were on specific classrooms where I knew the teacher would be an ally to me. Do you have any closing thoughts, Jessica?
Yeah, just to sort of add to that last question around, it just came to my head of what adults and teachers and faculty can do to be really supportive. I think there's also just a level of self-education that people can take on about educating themselves what it means to be able to create a good climate, not just for LGBT students, but for all students in your classroom, what you can do to understand the issues that certain students face, not just LGBT students, but students with disabilities, students of color, et cetera, to really fully understand the scope of the issues that students are facing. You know, while it would be great that there would be mandatory trainings for everyone on everything, we just know that that's not possible. But people have a lot of power in their own hands to self-educate.
Mm-hmm. And Tosh, did you have any closing thoughts?
Yeah, I'd just like to echo what Jessica said. I think it's really fantastic, folks, to just do a lot of self-education around this and, you know, really pay attention to what's going on around this bill. We're really excited about the Day of Action this Friday, March 6th at the Capitol, Salem. And it's going to be a fantastic, wonderful day with Basic Rights Oregon. So if you want more information about that, you can go to www.basicrights.org. Again, that's basicrights.org. I think this is a really fantastic, wonderful thing that's happening. So I really encourage folks to just follow along and see what's going on.
And real quick, what can youth do to get involved with Basic Rights Oregon in any way, shape, or form?
There are lots of ways. So one of the ways is, of course, to come to the Day of Action again, which is this Friday, although that's kind of short notice for folks. But we do have our main office here in Portland. We're always looking for folks to get involved, not only just in whatever general capacity they're interested in volunteering. But one of the best ways for young folks especially is through QPower, which Tosh mentioned earlier. We meet every other Monday, and I believe we'll be meeting not this coming Monday, but the Monday after. And again, that's really specifically a place for young LGBT and allied activists to come together and really be able to do some leadership development and to run their own campaigns and get the experience to get that political activist work out in the world.
Okay. All right. We're going to be going to a music break. After this, we're going to be talking to Sprout, who is a youth activist going to a young leaders conference in Washington, D.C.
Peace. and then let's throw down for the change and set on key. Maybe I'll be with you, maybe, maybe not. Maybe it'll take some time to find out what we've got. So the future's just amazing, possibilities and then let's throw down with the change and set on key. Maybe I'll be with you, maybe, maybe not. Maybe it'll take some time to find out. But we get.
All right, that was Janice Code with Suddenly May. And you're listening to The Other Team on KBOO 90.7 FM. Hello, Sprout, and welcome to the show.
Hi.
All right. So, Sprout, you are trying to get to the Junior National Young Leaders Conference. Can you tell us a little bit about that conference?
Well, it's for fifth graders who demonstrate academic excellence and great leadership potential to learn about leadership.
Ah, cool. And what do you hope to gain from this conference?
Well, I really want to learn about different kinds of leaders and what qualities these leaders had.
All right. And what are you hoping to contribute to the conference?
I want to bring humor and passion for animals and gay rights.
Ah, so you're interested in animals also?
Yeah.
Cool. Now, you have a history of gay rights activism. What originally got you interested in the gay rights movement?
Well, my parents always raised me to believe that everyone should be created equally.
Mm-hmm. Cool. And what was the first step you took in becoming an activist?
Well, I wrote songs about gay rights after the last Pride Parade, and I guess at the last Pride Parade, or before it, I never really noticed how unfair it was. And there was a protester who sort of made it click that gay people don't really have as many rights and feel unsafe sometimes.
Cool. What was it about that protester that made things click for you?
Well, he really made me feel uncomfortable and made me feel like I wasn't the same as everyone else.
Aww. What are some specific goals you hope to achieve through your activism?
I want my parents to be able to get married, and I hope kids feel safe no matter who they are.
Cool. And what does being a leader mean to you?
It means being able to speak out even when you're scared and being able to do something even if your friends might not think it's cool.
Cool. And how much money is it going to take for you to attend this conference, and how much money do you still need?
It's going to take about $2,500, and I'm a little over halfway there.
Cool. And if our listeners want to help Sprout get to the conference, then they can send the money to Sprout at 2100 Southeast Belmont. That's 2100-2100 Southeast Belmont, and money would indeed get to Sprout, and hopefully Sprout's going to be able to make it to the conference this time. And that's in Portland, Oregon, 97214. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us on the show today, Sprout.
Thank you for having me.
Yes. We're going to be going to another music break now, and after that we're going to be talking with Tassara from the city of Portland about some issues involving public transportation with TriMet.
No, you are beside me. Please, good.
touch. And I woke in a panic. I could barely breathe and I cried. But I saw you there naked asleep. And if tears can buy time, then I just let them fall. But I'd live for your smile and I can't take the storm. The moments keep on passing and some will wake. While you are still sleeping, it suddenly rains. And I would give anything for the glint in your eyes when you catch me staring at you. I would give anything just to spend a life in your smile. My greatest fears of the moment I'm just that I'll have. The way that you kiss, vanilla wax whispers, and freckles that fade into photos of someone who's too far away. And if tears can buy time, then I'd just let them fall. But I'd live for your smile, and I can't see the stone. The moments keep on passing, and some will wake. While you are still sleeping, it suddenly makes. And I won't waste any time, cause I know that our minutes are flying by. But I would give all of mine to spend a life in your smile. And I won't try to pretend that I don't know that all good things must have the rest. But I can't spend my life in your smile. My life in your smile.
Hello, this is Gray.
And this is Darwin, and welcome back to the show on KBOO. We are the other team, and this is 90.7 FM KBOO. And hello to Sarah, and welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hello. So what are TriMet's plans for Fairless Square?
Well, so glad you asked. Give me just a sec here.
Yeah, I see you've got all your information set out there.
I have lots of information. So, TriMet has, they have this whole documentation thing going on where they've got studies and studies, and I think that the studies are totally silly because you can't really track it. But they say they lose some, like, thousands and thousands of dollars a year because people who get on in Fairless Square and don't ride only in Fairless Square. So what they have several plans that they could implement in any combination. They might institute a $1 fare over all of Fairless Square, thus making it not fareless and making all of us wonder what they're going to call it now. And or they could restrict Fairless Square to the rail only. So it would apply to the streetcar, the blue, yellow, green, and red lines. And all the buses, you would still have to pay the whole fare that you pay in Zone 1, or possibly the $1 fare that would apply. And then another option, the one I like the most, is leave it the way it is. Yeah, I like that plan. And then there was a fourth one. Let me see if I can find it. It was something like, yeah, that's right. They were gonna change the boundaries of Fairless Square and make it so that Lloyd Center was not gonna be in fairly square anymore, so that you could ride everything out to just before Lloyd Center, and then you'd have to pay the normal Zone 1 price, or the $1 fare. And so they're not right now picking anything or ruling anything out, but I still think it's a silly idea.
So with the taking out Lloyd Center 1, it would just be the Lloyd Center stop specifically, and it Fairless Square would still extend into southeast or northeast?
Yeah.
Okay. Which is so pretty ridiculous.
But a lot of people ride it to Lloyd Center.
Yeah, like, exactly.
That's one of the main draws.
Right, right. Well, you know, here's an idea. They could spell Fairless F-A-I-R and F-A-I-R-E, and then it would still be Fairless Square. You'd just, you know.
Suck a lot more?
Yeah.
How do you, cool.
How do you think changing Fairless Square would affect youth?
Well, many adults, through their jobs, receive bus passes. But the jobs that youth tend to get, if they even have jobs, tend not to be the kind of long-term, really involved work that involves, you know, benefits and bus passes and stuff like that. So Fairless Square, I used to not have a job that gave me a bus pass, mm-hmm. and on the days when I didn't get paid in time in the months, because I buy a monthly pass, on the months when I didn't get paid in time or didn't get to a place where I could buy a bus pass in time, I would have to buy my fare to get downtown. And then traveling downtown, I would have to pay, if there were no Fairless Square, I would have had to pay a fare to get around because my workday was just long enough that my transfer no longer applied.
Right.
And it's a lot easier to have the Fairless Square and for youth to get around and see each other and get to jobs. And taking that resource away would make life way more difficult, particularly for homeless and low-income youth.
Right, right. And I feel like TriMet's plans to take out Fairless Square would also be as is unsubstantiated, but mostly people's experience with them, their history of targeting certain groups.
Yeah.
And
I wouldn't say unsubstantiated. They haven't looked into it, but yeah. That doesn't mean we don't know it.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so the is the Multnomah County Youth Commission giving any input on this issue?
Well, actually what's going on is that I am typing up a whole big briefing page on what's going on with TriMet and how it might affect youth, and then I'm going to give it to the Youth Commission, and they're going to write up a policy that is their, what they are going to try and do about this, what their opinion is, and get that out there.
Okay, so the Planning Bureau is working well with that commission on this issue then. Okay, awesome.
At least the youth planning program.
Yeah. All right. What can our listeners do to get their voices heard on this issue?
Well, TriMet is taking public comment on not only this, but on all the proposed changes they're going to make. They're cutting like 12 bus lines or 10 bus lines, and they're getting rid of weekend service on an additional 13. And so they're taking public comment through the end of this month. So if you want to get your comment in by 5 p.m. on the 31st.
Ooh, you are organized.
I am organized. Look at that. You can call them at 503-962-5806. Fax them at 503-962-6469 or email them at comments@trimet.org.
Okay, and could you repeat that information real quick for our listeners?
Mm-hmm.
Give them time.
Phone number 503-962-5806,
fax 503-962-6469, and email comments at trimet.org.
Okay.
Awesome. Should totally do it.
Yeah. Yes, you should. I've encouraged our listeners many times on this show to get involved, and I again want to reiterate to all you youth out there, to all you queer youth out there especially, it's important as a strong group in this city to get your voices heard and to make a difference. I know a lot of you have resources downtown. I know you need to get to, like, shelter and stuff quickly. I know you need to get to your appointments and everything. And I would hate to see those resources disappear for you all. So get your voices heard on this issue. Okay. If TriMet were to start charging riders in Fairless Square, what would they put the money towards?
They haven't said.
Really?
Yeah.
So they haven't clarified
any idea. Probably just go into general funding money. I think if they really do this, then it should go to educating TriMet's employees on how to deal with youth and how to not ostracize them and not just mess with them.
Right. Yeah, I've seen a lot of that. TriMet really likes to target youth in particular when it comes to things.
And actually, I have a couple. On Friday at 5 o'clock p.m. at the East Portland Community Center, the youth planning program is holding a focus group on the East Side MAX stops and possibly the head of security for TriMet, but hopefully someone pretty high up in TriMet is going to be there to hear comments, and also I believe someone from the Portland Bureau of Transportation, some adult planners from the Planning Bureau, and myself and my coworker Ashley. So, and that's a really good place to talk about how youth interact with East Side MAX stops. So.
Okay, so you all heard that, 5 p.m. on Friday at the East Side MAX stops. Be there.
East Portland Community Center.
East Portland Community Center. All right. Awesome. Be there. Now, you spoke on this briefly earlier, but could you just expound on what are the other changes TriMet is making that will affect riders?
Well.
Again with the organized, I like it.
Got
a folder, a laptop, everything.
I do have a folder. I organized a folder because I thought this is an important thing.
This really
and
is.
I wanted to make sure that I have all, had all the information I needed, so let's see. Me and my different pages. Okay. Well, 12 bus lines. Okay, was 12, not 10. Would be discontinued.
Oh.
They want to remove the 18 Hillside, 37 Lake Grove, 55 Hamilton, 60 Leahy Road, 63 Washington Park, 86 Alderwood, 153 South End Road Loop, 156 Mather Road, and 157 Happy Valley, because they think not very many people ride them. So they say fewer than 15 people boarding per vehicle hour. Not really sure what that means. And then three more lines, 33 Fremont, 41 Tacoma, and 74 Lloyd District, because those three would be removed because there are other buses or other alternative, like MAX or whatever, nearby. So they're like, well, we can just cut this because you'll have to walk a little farther, but you can still get where you're going.
Right.
And then 13 other bus lines would have their weekend service entirely discontinued.
Mm.
And then there are a lot of buses that they're just going to reduce the service on the weekend.
So they're reducing, they're wanting to reduce all these and wanting to cut out all these lines and get rid of Fairless Square, and they still haven't stated an agenda where any of this money would be going.
Yeah.
I find that a little sketchy.
It's a little sketch.
Yeah.
And I tried before this, I tried to find some information on where it would be going. It's not really there.
I actually was at the 74 stop today next to Lloyd's Center, mm-hmm. and there was a small sign up, and somebody had is trying to rally people to save Lloyd's Center and get their comments heard. I don't know if I have the address or anything with me, but there was an email address. But if you all like that stop, you can go to the 74 Lloyd Center and see the little poster and take one of the little pieces of paper and go online to the website or the email address that they give and get your comments heard on that specific stop if you care about that. So that's a good thing to know. I did want to ask another question earlier, but I didn't think we would have time. I noticed some youth in particular are still trying to find ways to be compatible with TriMet when they take their bikes on board. Is TriMet doing anything to become more compatible with cyclists?
TriMet, you're not going to hear them say this very loudly. They don't want people to bicycle.
Really?
Because it's okay on buses because you're only allowed to have it in the two racks on the front, and if those racks are full, then you don't get on the bus. That's just the way it is. On the Max, they don't, there's hooks for the bikes, and you can stand with them in the aisles or in the disabled spot if no one's there, but those are spots that could be filled by more people.
Right.
And because of the high volume of ridership during certain hours, the morning and afternoon commutes, it would be better for TriMet if they could pack more people in.
Ah.
And bikes take up spots that people could be standing in. Additionally, they have, like, park and rides for cars, and they do have racks for the bikes, but sometimes they're really ugly. They're ugly racks, and they have, like, boxes, and you have to call them and get a box and rent it, and there's a key, and it sucks.
Yeah, and with the system they have in place in some areas now, I've noticed it's a lot easier to get your bike stolen at a Max stop.
Yeah. Well, if you're not standing, I always sit where I can see my bike if I'm riding on the Max with a bike, but I just feel like if you stick your bike up on the hook and then you go and sit somewhere and you can't see it, it'd be so easy for people to just take off with
right.
your bike.
Right. And so that's another issue that youth have to face with TriMet is the incompatibility with bicycles because, you know, TriMet doesn't run 24/7. And, you know, youth and there's also places that, you know, your stops not quite walking distance, but not quite busing distance away from somewhere, right? So you want to take your bike, you know? It's just more convenient for you. So, you know, those are some other issues that TriMet hasn't exactly faced lately. Okay, I wanted to ask, do you have any closing comments or any additions to our conversation here?
Well, I wanted to mention that the Socialist Worker, it's a newspaper, is hoping to get together a group of citizens to shut down the changes that TriMet wants to make. And I don't really have contact information that I'm comfortable giving out
okay.
for them, but I'm also helping with that effort. And so if people want to get a hold of me,
okay,
that would be great. And also, supposedly, TriMet is holding some sort of a hearing where they had a bunch of open houses, and you could come and hear what they had to say and then write on a little yellow card what you had to say, a really small little card. And we had gone thinking that we would be able to actually speak on the issues there, and that's not the way it was working, but supposedly, there's a hearing in the future. They haven't set a date at all. But I should be getting email updates from them. And so I might have that information later on. But
And Tassara, do you have a work email or phone number where people can contact you?
I do. My work email is tdudley_z@ci.portland, P-O-R-T-L-A-N-D, .or.us. And I do have a work number as well, although I don't use that very frequently. I'm more likely to get emails. But my work phone number
is on a nifty business card.
It is on a nifty business card.
Can you repeat your email address for our listeners?
Yeah. tdudley_z at ci.portland.or.us. And the phone number that I have is 503-823-6828. That's 503-823-6828.
Awesome.
And I will have more information in the future, so if you contact me, I can get back to you with whatever.
Great.
TriMet comes out with.
Does TriMet have further information about all the changes on their website?
They do have lists of proposed changes and actual changes, such as, you know, now they're moving everything back to the bus mall. So that's those are the changes that are definitely happening. And then they've got a whole list of the buses that they're proposing to cut and change, and they're making lots and lots of changes on this proposed change sheet. And maps and budget information. The budget information, I looked, not very helpful, but what can you do?
Right. Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us. And I really appreciate you coming on the show and talking about these issues.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to reiterate to everyone out there, you need to get involved with these things because they do affect us. They affect our community and our city, and especially the resources downtown. I know it's really hard, especially for youth who have all their resources located downtown, to get from one place to another all in time. I'd really, you know, I'd love you all to just get involved, get on the websites, make your voices heard. You know, it doesn't matter if you have, like, no home or whatever. You can still put your voice to this because we all use public transport. Tassara, also known as Mayhem, could you please tell our listeners one more time what your email address is?
Definitely. tdudley @ci.portland.or.us.
Excellent. I wanted to make sure everyone knew you can contact us at theotherteamtalk@gmail.com, and we also have a Facebook group called The Other Team.
And if you would like anything you want to hear on the show or anything, please contact us. Please tell us, like, anything. You know, come join our Facebook and, you know, give us a shout-out and start a little message board, you know, whatever you want to say. I also want to reiterate, for those of you who want more information on helping out Sprout Chin, who we had on the show a little earlier, who is a youth trying to attend the conference in Washington, D.C., which is called the Junior National Young Leaders Conference. Please send your donations or your letters of support to 2100 Southeast Belmont, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Again, that's Sprout Chin at 2100 Belmont, Southeast Portland, Oregon, 97214. And I just wanted to talk a little bit about some resources here in Portland that youth can go to help get involved. Again, Basic Rights Oregon is always looking for youth to get involved. And, you know, there are a lot of resources and opportunities for youth out there to get involved in decision-making, leadership, and activism. And Bridge 13 is one of those ways. Bridge 13 is an activist group of queer youth, adults, and allies who do workshops around Oregon that focus on educating businesses, schools, and other organizations on how to treat the members of the queer community with equality. If you'd like to know more about Bridge 13 and what you can do to get involved, please contact Mahara at 503-872-9664, extension 38, or at Mahara's email address, MaharaS, that's MEHERAS, at CascadiaBHC.org. That's MEHERAS at CascadiaBHC.org. And that number again for Bridge 13 is 503-872-9664, extension 38. And in some show in the future, we are hoping to get Mahara on to talk more about Bridge 13 or another volunteer.
The Multnomah County Youth Commission is also something you should look into. If you're interested in getting your voice heard with citywide issues, you can find them online by going to the energy-saving version of Google, blackle.com, and typing in Multnomah County Youth Commission. Again, you can contact us at theotherteamtalk@gmail.com if you need to confirm any of the information you've heard on the show today or clarify anything or get more information. We'd be glad to let you know.
And the Multnomah Youth Commission isn't just city issues. Clearly, it's countywide as well. And so they have some very cool events coming up to kind of drive that home.
Excellent. And that is about all for the show today. We're going to be going to our final music. Thank you to Sara for being in. This song is from the album Dance, Dream, Dance, and it's called Afronaut.
Hey, good evening, everybody. You listen to KBO 90.7 FM. The time is now 7 o'clock, and coming up next is Hard Knock Radio with David E. But for right now, let's listen to the community calendar for the upcoming week. Again, you're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland.
This is the community calendar for Tuesday, March 3rd, 2009. The Children of the Revolution will be discussing political and social issues on Wednesday, March 4th from 4:30 to 5:30 p.m. at the People's Food Co-op at 3029 Southeast 21st Avenue, one block north of Powell Boulevard. Call 503-232-9051 to confirm. The Sisters Circle Empowerment for Women of Color meets Wednesday, March 4th from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. at the Women's Resource Center at Portland State University. Children always welcome. Call 503-725-9780 or 503-725-5672. Code Pink Meeting takes place today, Tuesday, March 3rd, from 6:30 to 7:30 p.m. at In Other Words Books, 8 Northeast Killingsworth Street at the corner of Williams. The meeting focuses on all the ways to get involved to help stop the war and bring the troops home now. The People's Farmers Market takes place Wednesdays, 2 to 7 p.m. It's a year-round market at 3029 Southeast 21st Avenue, one block north of Powell Boulevard. For more information, call Ariana Jacob at 503-232-9051. Fresh, free meal on a cold winter's night. Attend Food Not Bombs, a free vegan dinner spread held beginning at 5:30 p.m. on Tuesdays at Colonel Summers Park, Southeast 17th and Taylor, and on Wednesdays at Southeast 63rd and Foster. Bring your own containers. Today, Tuesday, March 3rd, from 7 to 9 p.m., there will be a free lecture on protecting children from environmental toxins at Legacy Good Samaritan Hospital Office Building Auditorium, 1040 Northwest 22nd Avenue, first floor. The sponsor is Rachel's Friends Breast Cancer Coalition. There is a free sack lunch concert Wednesday, March 4th at noon at the Old Church, 1422 Southwest 11th Avenue in Portland. Jennifer McBratney, soprano, with Michael Barnes, piano, perform works by Mozart, Chopin, and more. This has been Paula for the community calendar for KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. Listener-sponsored, volunteer-powered community radio, transmitting from Portland, Corvallis, and Hood River.